This is The Conversation. I am Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. The website for the show, in case you didn't know, is theconversationpod.com, where you can find all past episodes, images, links to your favorite social media outlets, and opportunities to donate to the show. If you are not a subscriber, you can certainly subscribe for free on iTunes or Stitcher. If you're on either of those platforms, just look up The Conversation, an artist podcast. My guest today is Adam Scheffer, who is a partner and I guess the lead sales director at Chime and Reed Gallery in New York. And it was quite a lovely conversation, lovely chat. And incidentally, a guest who was on this show not long ago, in introducing me to another potential guest, referred to me as an interlocutor. And that word seems to apply well to this particular conversation. That's the way it feels in any case. It's simply someone who takes part in a conversation. And certainly I am that. The secondary definition, apparently, is the performer in a minstrel show who is placed midway between the end-men and engages in banter with them. And certainly that is an ongoing objective, to engage in a little banter. We had a little banter here. Mostly, I think it was interlocutor in the sense of trying to procure hidden information. Doesn't interlocutor kind of sound like it should be that as well? Anyway, I'd be curious to know what you think of this conversation if I ask the right questions, too many of them. Adam performed very well, as you will hear. We'll talk more about that on the back end. I'm curious to hear what you think. My affiliate sponsor for this episode is Made with Color, which is a website building platform that was designed specifically for artists, designers, and other creative types. Madewithcolor.com. If you sign up for a year's membership by entering in the code conversation, all lowercase, you will get 29% off your first year of service. That's madewithcolor.com. Let's move on to the conversation with Adam Scheffer, and I will talk to you on the back end. Thank you very much for being here. Talk to you later. Okay, so I am speaking with Adam Scheffer. Hello, Adam.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very well today. Thank you.
Good. You are a sales director at Chime and Reed Gallery in Manhattan?
Well, yes, I am a partner in the gallery. I am director of sales, and we have the distinguished honor of being probably among the one or two most mispronounced gallery names in the world.
Ah, so I've already gone
Chime
there.
Chime and Reed.
Chime.
Chime and Reed.
Chime, right. I think I've actually heard that before, but I've probably heard it the other ways too. So anyway, yep. Chime and Reed, indeed. And Chime and Reed is probably what could be considered a sort of classic blue chip gallery, I would imagine. Now, did you actually get a medallion once you became a blue chip gallery, or did you have to apply for it?
Well, I think they issue you a card is actually how it happens, although I must say I have not seen it. I think galleries are generally measured by the level of accomplishment of the artists that they show and how they continue to contextualize those artists with maybe a little bit of a younger generation, some great group shows here and there, a piece of history showing an influence. So all in all, we sort of act as if we are in the role of museums with a commercial element, put it that way.
Right. Yeah, I think that sounds like a good description. I guess the first question that comes up without taking a break from the blue chip moniker for a second. It seems that you are, as a gallery, I should say, are fairly high up in the gallery sphere. Are you? But you're not. You're certainly not a mega gallery. So are you somewhere in the middle, or are you more sort of like an upper crust gallery, but not with chains?
Well, it's a good question. I would say that we are a small gallery with a big reputation. Rather than being a mega gallery, we are a boutique. So instead of being, say, a Walmart, we might be closer to a Barney's or a Bergdorf Goodman. There are 15 of us on staff.
Uh-huh.
Everything that you come across is going to be consistent in terms of quality, but there's a finite group of us. There's one location, and while we have the luxury of showing around the world in art fairs and in museum exhibitions, we've got a home base, and we'd kind of rather do a lot for a small group than really expand and try to take over the world.
Right. Well, I have to go back to, I'm a stickler for details, I guess. I don't know, people haven't really said that to me, but I notice it myself. And when you say you're a small gallery, but you have 15 staff members, that's pretty big. I think if you look at the LA gallery landscape, if you were to look at galleries that have about 15 employees, that would be considered among the largest galleries in town. Is it just different standards in New York, or how does that work?
I don't think so. I think it's more a question of geography, in that we have one gallery with one exhibition space.
Right.
And a core group of people who work there.
Right.
So everybody shares one room and shares a bunch of ideas. It's not like a bunch of offices and everybody has assistants who speak to assistants who speak to assistants who speak to other assistants. It's more like a huge team effort, like a kibbutz, something
right.
like that. I think, you know, what we do above and beyond everything else is function on behalf of art and artists.
Right.
That is really what we're here doing. However, at the same time, I think it would be unrealistic not to think of us as businesses that need to turn a profit, and we need to be able to keep artists in business and keep their studios in business and allow them to continue to have the economic freedom to experiment in the studio and to make some mistakes that will never go out in the world. And in order to do that, you need to have sort of a financial motor power. And that is a reality of any business. Even if you look back 30, 40, 50 years ago to some of the great dealers whose legacy we're still continuing in, like a Leo Castelli or a Virginia Dwan, these are people who had access to some real sums of money. So I think to divorce that aspect of art and money isn't realistic.
Right. Well, I'm not suggesting divorce. I'm just suggesting that Goldman Sachs is a rather notorious name to think about when it comes to finance and art, for that matter. But so, since you've brought it up, maybe could you elaborate on the financial support structure that you were referring to?
Sure. I mean, it's our responsibility to do what we can in order to keep the gears in motion for artists and their studios so that they can continue to make their work, have exhibitions around the world, to get studio space where they need it, to travel, to exhibit in museums and underwrite exhibitions that often not-for-profit spaces cannot bear the burden of.
Right.
And that comes down to the dealer. And part of that comes from the sale of artwork and how you deal with that financial aspect of the business that we're all in.
I feel like on one hand we could go on for a while talking about the structure of the gallery, the artists that you have, and sort of how the money filters through, and maybe we will get there at some point. But right now, I would rather get to you and what you do. I mean, are you, since you are the sales guy, for lack of a better description, is that how you spend a lot of your time working on sales, or is there a lot to go on beyond that particular task?
Well, it is a large part of what I do. That is undeniable. Selling art is important because it keeps things moving. However, you know, one of the luxuries that we have as art dealers is that our businesses are not quite as compartmentalized as they may be in another industry, by which it's essentially a business that's made up of interpersonal relationships. So therefore, if I happen to have a great rapport with somebody who runs a museum in the United Kingdom, and they happen to want to talk to me about an exhibition of one of our artists' work, even though I'm in the sales division, that may be something that I get involved in and then bring one of my partners in order to enhance that conversation. But things have a lot of flexibility in art galleries, and at least in a gallery of our scale, they do, and I like it that way. It makes me feel like it's a much more enriching job because it always has room to go in different tangents and to grow.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you mean about flexibility? I mean, flexibility
well,
to make a deal?
Well, I can be involved in selling, that I can be involved in advising artists on their career moves. The fact that I can be involved in museum shows or art fairs. There are a lot of different aspects of the business that tangentially come out of sales. And, you know, I think one of the interesting things about art galleries is that they're often run by and include people who are not necessarily trained as business people. Mm-hmm. And we all add something to different areas of the business in addition to merely selling art.
Right, right. So you don't come from business?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
I come from a studio art background.
Okay, talk about that a little bit.
Absolutely. I wanted to be a painter. And inherently, I knew that as much as I loved being in the studio, I never felt a compelling reason to make a picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually found myself much more interested in evaluating my friend's work than I was in making my own.
Right.
And finally, it got to a point where I realized that maybe this wasn't going to be the best career path for me because I had no burning desire to make a thing every day. Rather, it felt like some sort of obligation.
Right, right, right.
And that was always there, and luckily I learned pretty early on that I was going to have to make some very hard choices, and I did it right out of college as opposed to down the road.
That's brilliant of you. I actually had a while back another dealer, a Los Angeles-based dealer on the show who had a similar career change as you. His came later.
Well, the interesting thing is that I think what makes galleries so fascinating as business models is that they are often run by people who come out of the creative industry as artists or painters or filmmakers. And therefore, I think the best galleries tend to have an inherent sense of creativity in the way they present the work by their artists and the way they present themselves.
Right, right. I have to bring up the gender element just because I was thinking as you were talking about your recognition of where you might best be suited, you know, early on that it might not be in the studio, and then of this other guy that I referred to. And I just wonder, in your experience, is it possibly more the case that men go from the studio to the gallery in their career more than women, and women are, you know, sort of start more in the gallery? That could be completely wrong, but I just wonder if that's the case.
Not necessarily, but it's really something that's worth thought and discussion.
Right.
The interesting thing about people in the art world who function as dealers, and I tend to use the word dealer instead of gallerist because it sounds like a psychiatrist or something way too clinical for me.
Well, actually, let me interject for a second, Adam, because when I've done a couple of episodes utilizing a co-host who's a dealer, and when I introduced her, I said dealer, you know, and her and the other guest said gallerist, you know, and so it's kind of an interesting it's an interesting psychological association I think we have with either word. You're saying that gallerist sounds more, you know, clinical, like a, you know, like a psychologist, but some people might say that dealer maybe sounds a little too crude, or, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, it does sound like a brutal term, and unfortunately the generalization of a dealer, whether it's an art dealer, a car dealer, or a drug dealer, does not always bring good associations.
Right,
Right. Yeah. But you're going to stick with it over Gallerist.
I am, just because it's more organic for me in the American tradition. Maybe right. In Europe they refer to Gallerist because it translates better. But I'm an art dealer.
Sure. I wonder, going back to the being, a lot of creative people coming into the business, I kind of want to look into the way that you talk about the work. And I wonder how you navigate the waters of presenting work to people. I mean, if you look at your stable, it doesn't seem like that there's a lot of work needed for just about every artist because they're so well established. But I'm sure there are cases where, you find yourself talking about the work to people in a certain way, in that you are selling the work to them. So what are some of those experiences for you like?
Well, I think you always need to take into account the fact that somebody who's going to be in your viewing room looking at a work of art is more than likely going to be in many other viewing rooms on the same day.
Ah.
And what is it about the experience there that is going to set you apart despite the art and make them feel really good about it? And I think the problem is that there are quite a few galleries around that just don't make a habit of making anybody feel special when they're there.
Yeah.
And I think people should be entirely comfortable. I think they should know that I'm not the artist and that they should feel comfortable asking questions that otherwise, they might not want to do. I think allowing people to clear the air when they're there and really understand why it's a great work of art, why it speaks to them. If it doesn't, why not? Why maybe it could?
Yeah.
And if that's really a dead end, what would?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I spoke to a critic recently for the podcast, and he, and I'm sure this is not uncommon for him and his type, will go into galleries and he'll just get the hardcore, sales pitch or some version of the sales pitch. And I'm sensing from what you're saying that that's not what you do, and those conversations that you have in the showing room are much more nuanced and what have you. But I guess I wonder if you think that there's a threshold or there's a dividing line between dealers that, sort of unsolicited offer this sales pitch versus ones that don't, as the dividing line between something more amateurish or green and something more professional.
I don't think that there is a real threshold. I just know that when I go into a gallery, I know when it's being done to me.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because I'm sensitive about it.
Yeah.
But, I think about somebody who goes into a car dealership to look at a particular model and how they're dealt with.
Yeah.
And I think there are some people that understand the nuances of human condition, and there are other people who just see it as a job.
Yeah, right. So what about the understanding the nuances of human condition? When you have a situation where you have, whether it's an appointment that you have with somebody, that's been made and you're expecting them and they come in and you show them some work or some more of an impromptu type of situation, how does that play out? You sort of sussing them out or, how would you describe it?
Well, I think it's a combination of factors between virtual language, body language, the way they react to things, environment in which they're looking at them, how focused they are. There are a lot of signs that you can pick up along the way just to see how into it they are. And regardless of whether somebody walks out with an invoice or not, I want them to have had a good experience in our gallery, because there are times when people haven't bought things and they have come back and then they have.
Right. Yeah. I'm guessing that you can sort of sense that collector X is having a conversation with you, and you are recognizing that there is a longer term potential with this person, that, it doesn't look like they're going to be interested in this particular person, but I'm going to keep sort of having the conversation about this work, and this will be part of our ongoing relationship, and, next time or the time after that,
Absolutely. It would be very short-sighted not to think that way. Yeah. And it's a shame that some people do.
Yeah, as you say that, I realize I'm probably being a little too, you know, dealer 101 here. So let's help direct me towards a more sophisticated place of thinking around this. This is certainly stuff that not people listening to the show are going to be unfamiliar with, but others are going to be rolling their eyes. So I want to, you know, talk about some of the maybe more challenging situations. Maybe you can think of a couple of specific anecdotes where, you know, maybe you got thrown off your game a bit and had to sort of do some wild improvising.
Well, I always find it kind of a challenge when somebody comes in and acts as if they haven't done their homework when in fact they have.
Ah.
And they make it a game to catch you up.
Uh-huh.
And the less flustered you get, the more matter of fact and neutral and opaque you can be, the easier and more harmonious the resolution will come.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, some guys like to go into a gallery and they say that people at the front don't acknowledge them or whatever it may be. They come in a very defensive position. And it's unfortunate because I think in our world, nobody likes to be treated like a second-class citizen and nobody wants to be snubbed. And that's not really the way it is. And I think, like everything else, how you handle a difficult situation is as important as what actually transpires.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, somebody may go in looking for a fight, but you can't give him that.
Right, sure. Well, speaking of coming into the gallery, what is your policy? What is Chime and Reed's policy for the person behind the front desk? How are they supposed to welcome the person coming in? I mean, do you have a list of personality types or image types of people that come in and that they should welcome them accordingly, for example?
Well, there's certainly no reason not to be nice to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, every so often, the New York Times likes to write an article about how defensive Chelsea galleries are.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't always think that's entirely fair. Usually the people at the front are working, and they are there to acknowledge you if you come up and have a question or to assist you in one way or another. But they're not in a meet-and-greet kind of job by which they are going to engage you and walk you around the show. Often it's somebody who is in an entry-level position who has studied art or art history and is also doing many other administrative tasks in addition to sitting up in front and merely making sure that everything is safe and secure.
Right.
In our gallery, we tend to like to have the balance of one man and one woman up in front. It's just kind of organically always worked that way, and I think it's very nice and very harmonious, and it doesn't prescribe to this notion of there being a generic entitled gallerina. So we're quite different than many galleries.
Ah, got it. Yeah, my experience, or to sort of boil it down, is that there are three types of, and I'm saying this, I know that this might come off as a little pedantic to people listening, but for you know, introverted, sensitive artists, of whom there are, I'm sure, plenty listening, it matters, you know, when you go into a gallery. So, and I think there are three categories. There's the category one is particularly friendly, you know, sometimes to the point of being maybe a little overly friendly as far as like offering to answer your questions or even, you know, sort of show you something or whatever, ask you about some of the work. The middle is that they acknowledge you and they're busy, but, you know, they warmly greet you. And then the third category is more of a snub type situation. And yeah, and I'm sure you get that in a lot of the bigger galleries in any city. So I guess I'm hearing from you that you hope to have your front desk people be somewhere in the middle.
Yes, I think it's very important to the way people perceive the gallery from the minute they walk in.
Right, right. But you have to go on word of honor, basically, because it's not like you or your other colleagues are going to be monitoring these people at the front.
Right, but they're very well trained, and they're generally people with extremely good judgment.
Ah.
And a general sense of kindness.
Okay.
You know, if somebody is coming in and obviously they are disabled, we are going to offer to assist them.
Right. Got it. Okay. Well, getting back to what you do, are you spending about as much time outside of the gallery as in? Do you spend more time in the gallery? And when you're outside of the gallery, what are the kinds of locations that you're going to?
I'd say that I'm in the gallery about 60% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
The remainder, I am either at art fairs, or I am with artists at their studios, or accompanying them at exhibitions around the world, or tasks of that nature, usually artist-related.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the client entertainment are things that can be done in the evening.
Right.
I like to be in the gallery because, as I mentioned, we kind of, you know, wear a lot of hats, and I like to be accessible.
Right.
And I like to be there when at all possible. We live in this very exciting moment, which is the
right.
advent of the International Art Fair and Biennial,
right.
which requires us to take it on the road, as it were,
yeah.
many, many times a year. So while it is important for us to be in the gallery, there's also some vital business to be done by people who certainly just don't make it to New York City to come in and walk around West Chelsea.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have lost opportunities for artists if we didn't take advantage of being in other places at certain times.
Sure. What about the JPEG culture? How noticeable is that with your gallery?
It's certainly an inherent part of how we do business. I think it's been an amazing tool in terms of speeding up business as we live in a much more sped up kind of world.
Right.
The fact that we can take a digital image and send it to somebody and they can react and then come into the gallery and see it, it's a lot easier than the old-fashioned way by which we used to get a photographer and schedule a date when the gallery wasn't open, and they would come in and they'd take various types of photographs, and we'd wait for them to go to the lab, and then they'd come back, and then we'd put it in the mail.
what about...
We live in a faster world, and this is a way of doing faster business.
But some people choose
to acquire work right from that image. Others do not.
Right.
And really, I don't judge people one way or another. If they are trained enough to be able to extrapolate and understand what that will look like, say they know that artist's work like the back of their hand, or they collected in depth already, that may be sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
For another person, they'll want to come back on 5 Saturdays and have a look. And you know what? That's their prerogative, too.
Okay. So the speculative element is something that's fairly minimal, is what you're implying.
I think so.
Yeah.
You know, I think what's confusing is that we live in a world where art has gotten relatively expensive and the cost of living has gotten very expensive, and we live in a very specific kind of community of people who can afford to acquire luxury goods like art, silver, watches, gold, etc. And
wealthy people, of course. Yes.
Absolutely. And there are very few opportunities where you could buy a wonderful painting for $1,000 and pay it off over a couple of years,
mm-hmm.
like, say, people would do in the 40s or 50s.
Hmm. Well, that sounds like you're discounting a lot of, emerging art by saying that, aren't you?
Well, not necessarily. I was trying to draw a parallel between the collector of yesteryear and how art was acquired back then.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I love to do on my off time is go to studios of lesser-known emerging artists in Brooklyn, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have the opportunity to buy great works of art by young people just starting out for, you know, $1,000 or so.
That's right.
It's very
right.
exciting to be involved in that.
Yeah.
You know? The situation is that the sort of entire spectrum of the value of art has changed so dramatically in front of our eyes as we live now in this global market with billionaires from all over the world.
Right.
I think the number of collectors has changed so exponentially that the standards have changed tremendously too.
Right, right. So you, as a dealer, you obviously have no limitations being a collector, which is nice. So tell me a little bit about what you collect.
Sure. I mean, look, primarily I collect work by gallery artists. But occasionally an artist that we work with will send me to go look at somebody that he thinks is doing really, you know, interesting work. Maybe a young artist, maybe a slightly overlooked, more kind of older person. And if it speaks to me and I have the opportunity, maybe I'll acquire work. I love getting recommendations from other artists as to what to see. There is nothing more valuable to me.
Right.
Nothing more rewarding, because it teaches you something about the way they see their work, the way they see other people's work, and they're out there much more. You know, I have a real job to do. They are part of a community of other artists where they have a dialogue and they see things, and they're in group shows or they're asked to curate shows. And I think to be out of touch with that is deadly.
Sure. And what about the gallery artist's work that you acquire? What kind of arrangements or deals go on there, if you don't mind my asking?
I certainly don't mind you asking. I'm not sure I want to discuss it, though, because everything's very personal. And,
right.
You know, it would be like, you know, asking a family member, you know, if they could give you a good deal on a car.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's the only analogy that's, I think, necessary in this scenario. Very good. And you mentioned before you were talking about the various duties or the things that you do for your job outside of the gallery. And you mentioned in passing client entertainment in the evening. How many evenings a week generally does that tend to be?
I'm either with artists or clients 5 nights a week.
Uh-huh. Are you an extrovert then?
Let's just say I love my downtime.
Interesting. So I'm guessing then that you're somewhere on the middle. You're equally parts introvert, extrovert.
Well, I think so.
Yeah.
That's a good way to put it. And there's nothing I'd rather do than spend time with artists.
Right.
You know, maybe it's because being an art dealer is as close to the mark as I'm ever going to get. And for some way, it's also very reassuring and rewarding for me.
Sure. Yeah. To be more specific, if you spend an evening, say, with a combination studio visit / dinner with an artist, which I imagine is a scenario, correct me if I'm wrong, that you find yourself in pretty often, versus...
Regularly.
Yeah. Versus going to a dinner party, you know, with like anywhere from 5 to 12 people, I imagine that the former is going to be a much less taxing for you, you know, as far as your downtime quotient than the latter.
Generally, it is. For the most part, you're going with an artist or somebody that you know relatively well.
Yeah.
And I think that there is already a level of comfort that has set in there.
Right.
When you go into a client entertainment situation, there may be new variables that come up. There may be some particular business situations you want to discuss with them. You may be introducing a new work of art that's come into the gallery. You never know where it's going to lead, but the artists are like family, and it's extremely comfortable to be with them.
And a lot of your artists are living in New York?
Fortunately, yes. And interestingly enough, those who aren't, I tend to either speak with, text with, or email with many times a day.
Wow.
Which is the beauty of modern technology.
Yeah, indeed. But I mean, with all those artists, you know, plus all the other things you're doing, it sounds like a dizzying amount. I mean, you know, look, I'm being completely naive here, but because this is the age we live in. But still, we're talking about one individual and their work, which of course I'm sure you're passionate about and you love and all, but that's a lot of communication in a given day.
Well, I like my downtime.
Well said, yes. All right, well, let's get specific. So you've got Barry McGee as one of your artists. Who is he recommending to you to go check out?
Barry will often recommend an artist who maybe is the next generation in the Mission School, or somebody that I'm not aware of who is an historical figure, say, deeper in the graffiti art movement. I mean, it was quite fascinating. Barry was giving a lecture around the time of his mid-career survey at the ICA Boston. And he was up there, and the curator was asking him questions about Bay Area figuration in relationship to the images in his work. And Barry looked out across the audience and saw an extremely well-known, within the graffiti art world, artist that, frankly, I had never heard of. And he immediately called out the name, and the artist came down, and Barry asked him to be a part of the discussion.
Wow. Uh-huh. That's nice.
Barry is an amazingly generous, amazingly kind, wonderful, incredibly talented individual who is really reshaping art history, certainly bringing an important movement to the forefront. And he has such a knowledge of his historical precedents, like this particular artist, that was an instance where I learned something really vital about where Barry's work came from, that I had never read in the book.
Who was the artist that you're referring to?
His name was Lee Quinones.
Okay.
And he's in Boston, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he's very well recognized and celebrated in the world of street art, but I just didn't know him.
Sure.
So I learned something really interesting from Barry's recommendation at that moment.
Right, okay. Are there any other artist recommendations that come to mind that you think you would like to mention?
Well, we work very closely with Tal R, who is an extraordinary artist, painter, sculptor, furniture maker, a real Renaissance man. And Tal is a fascinating character because he is of Israeli descent, but he was raised in Copenhagen. And his knowledge of artists, both from the Israeli tradition as well as from the sort of Nordic tradition, is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Then you couple it with the fact that he has been the head of the painting department in Dusseldorf for many years. He recently retired. He brings with him this whole knowledge of artists as broad as Nolde, Munch, to Per Kirkeby, to younger artists in Germany right now who were students of his.
Mm-hmm.
That's a manner by which my relationship with Tao has grown exponentially, because I've learned about all of these other artists through him.
Right, right. Okay, well, where should we go from here? I feel like there's still a lot of territory that we could cover when it comes to what you do, but I'm not sure where to go. So help me out here, Adam.
Well, I think the idea of the fact that we live in this global art world,
yeah,
and that because of this extraordinary internet technology that we have now too,
mm-hmm.
So many things are possible. And the world is opening up in a way that I never could have imagined 25 years ago. The fact that we are doing art fairs all over the world. There are biennials all over the world. There is a whole recognition of artists now from the East and the Southeast that were so marginalized for decades. My aunt and uncle were the only collectors of Indian modern and contemporary art in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And at that time, what they did seemed so out there to me.
Mm-hmm.
That I couldn't even understand why you would want to acquire works of art that seemingly had no value.
Mm-hmm.
They were just these objects from India. Now, there is a thriving economy, culture, museum exhibitions, demand, and all of the major galleries around the world, too, are taking an interest outside of the traditional sort of New York, Chicago, Los Angeles sphere of Western art.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know?
So you come from a fair amount of an art and cultured family / background?
Well, actually, that gets very personal, but I'm happy to talk to you about it. When I was a little boy, I was a real nerd, and I was a terrible athlete. But I always liked going to the museums because it was a sort of contemplative, solitary environment, and I loved looking at pictures.
Uh-huh.
So my parents made a deal with me.
Mm-hmm.
If I joined the Little League team and I played baseball,
uh-huh.
or I played soccer or ice hockey each season,
uh-huh.
in the morning on Saturdays, they would take me to the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston in the afternoon.
Wow.
And that's how I think this whole thing started.
Interesting. What sport did you choose?
Well, every season I had to do one. So I it was soccer in the fall. It was baseball in the spring. It was hockey in the winter. And I was never very good at any one of them.
But it sounds like you weren't embarrassingly horrible, on the other hand.
Well, let's just say I participated because I knew what would come in the afternoon.
Yeah, right. And that made it all the less painful, presumably.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Well, getting back to the gallery to chime and read, the way that you were describing what you do for your artists sounds unbelievably enviable, you know, for any artist listening to this, including myself. What, I mean, let's just acknowledge the obvious that artists have to be at a certain place in the market and the institutional recognition. They have a certain level of market and institutional success / recognition. Those are a couple of things. What else? Maybe you could talk sort of abstractly about somebody or some artists who are in consideration at the moment. Are there any in consideration at the moment, or are you overstocked as it is?
Well, I think it would be very short-sighted, again, for you to just kind of draw the blinds shut and say, we're full. We don't take commitments lightly. And often, we will really want to watch and investigate an artist and their work for a long period of time before we start to make a commitment. I've never been the kind of person who gets married after the first date. I'm a little bit more cautious, and I think we all are at the gallery. And there are instances where, say, with a great painter like Chantal Joffe, we watched her work for, 5, 6, 7 years. We kept seeing paintings in group shows, in museum group shows, in art fairs, and we kept reacting to them, and they kept evolving, and they kept becoming more complex, and they kept holding our interests. And we kept coming back to them. And then eventually we decided, you know, it would be really nice to go and meet the artist, which we did. And then we took a painting into the gallery and had it in a group show. And we were very successful with it. And we continued a dialogue with her. And eventually she was asked to join the gallery. And it has been a wonderful relationship. And we are going to have our third exhibition of her work this coming May.
Mm-hmm.
But we're very cautious with these things.
Sure.
We really look around. We don't jump on things necessarily because they're hot and trendy. It's just not our style.
Sure.
About 3 or 4 years ago, somebody came up to me in front of the gallery and said, "Dude, you got to go out and get one of those Chinese artists." And I just kind of looked at him and was gobsmacked because that's not how we look at our relationship with artists. So it was a little strange. Not that we wouldn't take on an artist from the East. We just, you know, it hasn't evolved that way yet, and it may.
Well, anybody who gives you, you know, a 5-cent piece of advice, that's what it's going to be worth ultimately. So, yeah, gobsmack. That's a good one. When Chime and Reed was in its early life, was there a period of more experimentation or, you know, untested waters, or has it always been kind of a blue chip operation?
Well, I think by virtue of the fact that we have had relationships with artists and work that tends to have been well along its way by the time the gallery started.
Yeah.
And when I say that, I mean artists such as Louise Bourgeois and Joan Mitchell and William Eggleston, for instance, when they joined the gallery, their careers were already at a level of accomplishment that was art historical.
Sure.
And then what happens is as you develop a program, you hope that you have some historical people, you have some slightly emerging people, but there should be common trends. There should be relationships among the artists and their work, common concerns. It doesn't have to be one school of thought, but they need to have either a visual and or a theoretical relationship. For instance, I can't tell you how many times people come into a viewing room in our gallery and they see, say, five works of art hanging there by various artists, and they think, God, this room looks so great just the way it is. I'd like to take it all. And it's because this is how we think about the artists that we work with.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it seems to me that by the time an artist gets into Chime and Read, as this recent example that you mentioned, they no longer qualify as an emerging artist. So it seems in theory that to be an emerging artist within the stable of Chime and Read is an impossibility.
Oh, I wouldn't say it's an impossibility. I would say we go through life with our eyes wide open, and artists continue to evolve, and artists continue to mature, and new contexts are always provided out there by group shows and museums. I would say that for the real emerging artists, people still very much in their 20s, right out of art school, they should do themselves a favor and get into group shows at not-for-profit spaces. Go to the places where dealers like myself like to go and be acquainted with new things.
Like where?
You know, there is always like a White Columns or Artist Space or LAX in Los Angeles. I mean, these are the great hybrid breeding grounds.
You know, it's
for the history of contemporary art.
You know, but Adam, it's a lot easier said than done to do that. You know, White Columns has a limited number of shows. LAX has an even more limited number of shows. So showing at like an LAX, is equivalent to showing at a pretty established gallery. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely. Artists who can get into group shows at these places should. But, you know... Maybe that's the threshold for galleries that are looking around.
Well, I think any of the not-for-profit opportunities out there are interesting. I think that Artist Space, Irving Sandler Artist Files are really fascinating to go through.
Uh-huh.
I think the online availability now of being able to have your images up there... there's nothing better than getting a recommendation from another artist.
Sure.
To get somebody else into your studio.
Yep. Right.
I'm not saying it isn't. I'm not saying it isn't easy. I know how hard it is, and that's why I couldn't do it.
Right. Right. But I'm just going to hammer you a little bit harder on this, and you can push back however you want. But I'm just going to sort of make this final case that. Yeah, I appreciate the evolution that an artist will continue to have after they're in your gallery. But I guess I want to just make the sort of follow-up argument, which is, have any of your artists been dumped from the gallery or whose careers have kind of faded into nothing? And if not, then it's really hard to make a case for Chime and Read showing emerging artists.
Well... we stand by our artists pretty firmly. It seems like, you know, in one way or another, when we, you know, put that ring on our finger, we really mean it. Sometimes
you're using the marriage analogy again. You like that one.
I don't know why. It just comes up.
It's like a courtship.
So personal to me.
It's a courtship.
Maybe that's why.
Yeah.
I guess so.
Yep.
I think also, you know, unless it were up to an artist who wanted to take a different path for one reason or another, I mean, we're really here to stay with them. In terms of emerging artists, you know, again, it comes back to the very beginning of our conversation that we do consider ourselves small. We are a boutique, and we would rather do a lot for a small group than get really big and continue to take on people.
Yeah,
and not be able to do as much for them. And when you add but you don't subtract, you inevitably get into that problem.
We'll elaborate on that a little bit, if you will. And obviously, you don't have to name any names. I'm sure you won't for feel of,
sure.
of lawsuit. But so when a gallery takes on perhaps more artists than it can handle or a large stable, So only sort of a core group of those artists, maybe even a small core group, are going to get sort of the, you know, the VIP treatment or, you know, and support. But others are basically, they're going to be shown, but otherwise they're going to be left to their own devices? Or how would you categorize it?
It's not really a theoretical situation. It's more a situation about time and manpower.
Right.
You only have so many exhibition slots a year. For instance, we do about between 8 and 10, depending on when the holidays fall.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to be about 5 Saturdays long.
Mm-hmm.
And you can only do so many shows a year.
Yeah.
And so for a number of artists who are emerging, for instance, there is an economic reality that they need to have an exhibition every so often. And when you work with a gallery that doesn't have that many spaces to be able to do it or can't expand their program to another space where they have more slots, it can become very limiting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right.
Especially if you don't have another gallery somewhere in the world.
Yeah. And you're bringing me back to what your duties that we talked about earlier, one of them being going to artist studios, and another, if I remember right, going to the shows of your artists elsewhere outside mm-hmm. of New York. Now, I'm trying to imagine that scenario. You are going, say, to Los Angeles, or maybe you're going to Berlin, better example, to be at the show of one of your artists. What is that like? I mean, they've got presumably got their whole crew there. You know, they've got the gallery there. Are you just basically going to sort of show your face, be supportive, that kind of thing? Or is it more complicated than that?
Well, it is more complicated. Sometimes they don't have a crew.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's a one-person band.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes, because you're the person who works so closely with them,
right.
and they don't have a huge studio full of assistants,
right.
they need that kind of reassurance.
Mm-hmm.
Often, dealers can be a voice for an artist who just isn't comfortable
mm-hmm.
socially.
Right.
And they need you in order to support them and protect them and often make things happen at that exhibition that really they shouldn't have to do.
Yeah. And you're making me wonder about the sort of more ongoing relationship, the ongoing relationship between you and your colleagues and the artists. Generally, I'm sure you're not going to come clean with any dirt on this, but I mean, do the artists understand, you know, the boundaries, the relationship, or is it permissible, or is it, you know, is it understandable under certain circumstances that they would, you know, in a moment of panic come to you? Or is there no such thing because, you know, they've got it all figured out and everything, you know, moves along smoothly like a well-oiled machine?
Mm-hmm. Everybody's different. There are certain artists that I know need me
yeah.
at certain moments, and I can actually preempt that in a way by which they don't get to the crisis management. They're actually supported and comfortable all the way through it. Other artists I know, you know, will call me on a Sunday night because some curator called them who wants to come first thing in the morning, and they don't know what to do.
Right.
They don't want to say no. They don't want to say yes. They'd love to have them there. They're not sure that they have completed work, or what they have they don't think is their best work, and it's experimental.
Right.
And there are ways that, you know, you work together to coach them in the same way that they would help tell me about the intentions behind a work that I might find a little bit more complex than I'd be able to get my mind around.
Right. So you're down.
It's very symbiotic.
Well, I was going to say, so your downtime, your precious downtime, is being invaded by one of your artists on a Sunday night. Is it usually a pretty clear cut case for you to say, you should have this curator to your studio, or, you know, how does that work usually?
It's really on a case by case basis, depending on what I think is going to be good for them.
Right.
I will tell you, in terms of time, I always take the call.
Yep.
If for some reason I'm in the shower and I miss the call, I call them back.
Yep.
And if I can't talk, I set up a time when I can.
Okay. Right.
But I have learned to set boundaries mm-hmm. that are very comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I also want them to know that they're not out there alone. That's
right.
really the most important thing.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
an artist said to me the other day, the reason why I show in this gallery is because you make me feel safe.
That's
and you know
beautiful.
What? Having somebody say that to you is better than money in the bank.
Wow, that's sweet. It's like
I thought so.
It's like you and your sons and daughters a little bit, huh? I mean, do you see
yeah,
yourself?
It's like me and my dachshund.
Okay, so you see them as pets. More than people, huh?
Now that's not fair.
Well, Adam, you've been pretty unflappable, I have to say. Is there anything that we've left out thus far, that we would be remiss in not mentioning?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. I will tell you a funny story about when I was young and just started in this business.
That sounds
and
great.
And I was working at the front desk of an art gallery.
Can you
so
name it?
So it pertains to that. And I was trying to do business, and I was answering 5 phones at once, et cetera. And somebody came to the front desk, and I said, may I help you? And they said, yes, Cindy Sherman. And I said, oh, okay, just a moment, please. And I went in the back, and I came out a few minutes later, and I said, I'm sorry, there's no Cindy Sherman here. No, I am Cindy Sherman.
Nice.
Well, yeah. Well, I
at least there was
live that one down.
Right, right, right. What gallery was that? Are you allowed to say?
Oh, it's not even around anymore.
Got it. Well, that is a good anecdote to end on, Adam. Thank you very much.
You're welcome
for your unflappability and for your generosity with sharing, what you do with us.
It's my pleasure. I love it.
Thank you so much. And we're out.
Thank you again very much to Adam for being so unflappable and such a good sport. I appreciate his sportiness. And let us know what you thought of the conversation, the questions, the answers, anything, if you will. I really appreciate your being here. Once again, the website for the show is theconversationpod.com. This show appreciates your support, both financially. You can donate via PayPal through the website. And social media, you can support the show by becoming a follower on Facebook, on Twitter. You can go to iTunes, which is linked through the website, write a nice review about the show, which will bring more people to the show. We always want more people for this show, so help us grow the show by also spreading the word. Word of mouth helps too. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you for being here. I encourage your feedback. And I appreciate you listening, even if you don't give feedback. And I will talk to you soon. In the meantime, good night and good luck.